Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM. And all that is now, and all that is gone, and all that's to come, and everything under the sun is in the shoe, and the sun is a great spot on me.
Hello, good evening, and welcome to the Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. Good evening, John, firstly.
And good evening, Ben. Hi, everyone.
Hi, everyone, indeed. As ever, our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie, and the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032. You can also catch us live on the internet at dublincityfm.ie and also as a podcast. And we're going to start, as usual, with what to see in the sky over the coming week.
Yes, and we will start with the International Space Station, as usual. You've just missed it, in fact. If you didn't see it streaking across the sky about 6 minutes ago, you're not going to see it again until tomorrow at 6:37. And quite a good pass, actually, 2 minutes, which is quite good. Maximum height will be 16 degrees above the horizon. And, as I say, on, let me just see, on the 18th, 5:50 p.m. So they're all quite early this week, Ben. Again, around the 2 minutes sort of passes, which is...
Not great passes this week. I think if we wait another couple of days, it'll be higher and brighter. And hopefully we'll have clearer skies too.
Yeah, it's not too bad. It hasn't been too bad. But we have another week and a half or so before it disappears away for its other little rip around the world. That's what it does. Now, Mercury, just looking at those actually a minute ago. So Mars, Mercury and Venus are in the same vicinity, if you can point yourself in that way. So Mercury, of course, remains 11 degrees lower left of bright Venus. And that's in the dawn all this week, so that's the best time to see that as well, and remain as at a magnitude of minus 0.2, which is okay, still pretty good. Magnitude 4 is Venus. It's the morning star just at the moment, and it's in the southeast during dawn. It's getting lower every week, which is not really good if you're a Venus fan. And as I mentioned, though, nearby is not only Mercury, but there's the sparkly orange star Antares, which is plus 0.1. Mars is just to the lower left of Mercury. That's to say, the three of them all together in bright dawn in a mere magnitude of 1.4, which is quite dim and quite difficult to see. Jupiter, still, it's up there at the moment, quite high in the sky, minus 2.5 in Aries. It's the bright white dot, very high in the south in the early evening and less high in the southwest later at night. And it sets at around 1 a.m., Saturn, still quite easy to see, although it is plus 0.1 in the scale, and it's sinking lower in the west-southwest during and after dusk, and sets at 7 to 8 p.m., depending where you are, and if you're looking at the horizon or trees or whatever. Uranus and Neptune, these are the two elusive ones, as always, magnitude 5.6 and 7.9, so if you are wanting to have a glimpse of any of these planets, just follow the path of the sun and the moon, and they all go the same direction, and they just a degree or two above where the sun will go across the sky is where you'll get to see all these planets as well. So that's what to see just in the sky at the moment.
Thank you, John. Yes, just as a pointer for Jupiter, although it's very hard to miss now, it's the first really bright object you'll see in the sky in the evening as it gets dark, as you mentioned, in the south as it gets dark. But on Thursday the 18th, it's that very bright object just below the moon, 1.5 degrees below the moon, about three moon diameters below the moon. Excuse me. And on Saturday the 20th, the moon will be to the lower left of the Pleiades. So we have mentioned the Pleiades star cluster before, which is in Taurus. But if you're not sure where it is, if you find the moon easy enough, of course, and then moon is to the lower left of the Pleiades, which means the Pleiades is to the upper right of the moon.
Yeah, it's quite easy to see because I've been watching it over the last week or so because you've got clouds disappearing, coming in, clear skies and everything. So it's virtually overhead at the moment. And so is the moon is, just quick calculation, about a third of the way and just maybe slightly more.
Mm-hmm.
Yep, it is. Mm-hmm. And they're all pretty close to each other, Jupiter. And but the Pleiades, if you have a pair of binoculars.
I was about to say that, yeah. That's a lovely sight in an ordinary cheap pair of binoculars. You'll see many more stars than you can see, of course, with the naked eye. And if you're a Pluto fan, and I don't mean the Disney character.
Yeah.
I mean the former planet. We don't want to upset you, John.
Nope.
Being the blue.
I'm not.
He's still protesting. Won't accept that it's been demoted from planetary status. It is a solar conjunction at the moment, which means from our point of view here, the sun is between us and Pluto. You can't see Pluto at the moment. It's on the far side of the sun. Speaking of the moon, the 35% waxing crescent moon is currently above our horizon and it will set later tonight at 20 minutes to midnight. It'll be just slightly larger then. We'll be able to see 37% of it by then, and when it rises again just after 11 tomorrow morning, it'll be a 32% phase as we head towards the first quarter moon on Thursday at 4 a.m. to be precise.
Now we have to, I think, speak about the doomed U.S. lander.
Ah, indeed.
Yeah, and it's the private U.S. lander that has been hemorrhaging its fuel since the onboard little episode or explosion at the start of the journey. And it's still somewhere chugging along, snapping selfies. It's doing quite well for itself, to be honest, and running science instruments as it travels through space. Now, where is it going to land? Or where is it going to be guided to? Or are they just going to let it hit the surface of the moon, when they let it fly past just out into wherever it's going to? We just don't know. But they do reckon a stuck valve may have doomed the private Peregrine moon lander mission. This is according to the Astrobiotic or the Astrobotic. And they've homed in on a potential cause for the problems plaguing its moon lander. So there is, at this stage, no way, unfortunately, that this is going to get
land
to
on the moon. Well, it's not going to do a soft landing.
No.
They may do a hard landing. It was a privately built probe, although NASA did pay them, that company you mentioned, Astrobotic, paid them $100 million for it. And they will get another chance in November when the Griffin lander, transporting NASA's Viper rover, is going to launch to the South Pole. And there was an amateur astronomer by the name of Tony Dunn. He's after using some public available data, and he was plotting the spaceship's current course, and he said, according to his calculations, that it will collide with the moon on January 23rd, but of course they may, as you said, maybe give it a bit of a boost with the bit of fuel that's left. The problem was, or is, that it's lost a lot of fuel. But there are some other experiments and equipment on it, shall we say, that it seems to be still working. I think some of them were owned by a German company, and not just a German company, a few other places as well. And it's the third private entity, I should say, to have failed a soft landing, following an Israeli probe and also a Japanese company probe as well. As we mentioned before, I think when we mentioned this last week, that there are some human ashes on board, and I can't remember some well-known people, but one of the native peoples of North America, the Navajo, they've actually been to the White House to protest about putting human ashes on the moon or crashing such stuff into the moon. They say it desecrates a celestial body. And apparently we, the human race, have already left some 180 tons of material on the surface of the moon since the first Soviet impactor crashed back in 1959. But you're talking about the the Apollo rovers and the Apollo landers and, of course, a lot of other probes as well.
Yeah, just an email or text in from Alan in a cloudy Kildare. He missed the only ISS pass just a few moments ago, about 15 minutes ago at this stage. It was too cloudy. And what has been a stunning moon was now gobbled up by a cloud as well. Yep, so it's not so bad up here, actually. We got to see it just on the way in, and it's probably building up. So thanks for the message, just to let you know what things are like down in County Kildare. Now, I believe there's a self-eating rocket out there which could help take a big bite out of the space industry. Now, I don't know whether you have a better aspect on this, but there are new developments developing on a newly and nearly century-old concept for a big self-eating rocket engine. And what does that mean?
Well, thanks to some engineers up there in the University of Glasgow, they have built and fired the first unsupported autophage rocket. They call it autophage. It's the Latin word for self-eating. So basically, it consumes part of its own body for fuel, and the engine works by using waste heat from the combustion to sequentially melt its own plastic fuselage as it fires, and then the molten plastic is fed into the engine's combustion chamber as additional fuel to burn alongside its regular liquid propellants, which are a mix of gaseous oxygen and liquid propane. Now, the little rocket they have built, or engine they have built, has produced a force of 100 newtons of thrust in a series of controlled experiments, which is not a lot. Before we get anything to lift off the ground, we're going to have to ramp that up substantially. But they have the plastic they use is high-density polyethylene plastic tubing, or HDPE, as we call it. Mm-hmm. In the term, many people will be familiar with HDPE, which is high-density polyethylene plastic tubing. But, and it can be controlled. They've demonstrated its ability to be throttled, restarted, and pulsed in or off, so they can control it. And essentially, this means, because a conventional rocket structure usually makes up between about 5 and 12% of its total mass, the tests show that this particular engine can burn a very similar amount of its own structural mass as propellant. And essentially, then you can use some of that mass to have a bigger load, and it essentially makes the whole operation cheaper, as it burns its own, as it eats itself or burns its own mass. You can use that mass then to have heavier loads. Makes the whole episode, shall we say, or the launch, a little bit cheaper. And I reckon it won't be too long before it can be used to launch mostly nano satellites, or very small satellites, into low Earth orbits.
Yep. Now, this subject keeps coming up every now and again. What does space smell like? So, the exotic chemistry of planetary and interstellar space produces a bouquet, would you believe, of unusual aromas, if only there were air in space in which to smell them. Now, unfortunately, we are not able to smell them, but space, of course, we know as an airless vacuum, so technically you cannot smell anything in space. If you tried, it wouldn't last too long. You'd be not alive at this stage. Space is not a complete vacuum, and this is where this happens. So there are a few molecules, atoms, and this, that, and the other, which have their own strong odors when we smell them on Earth. And learning about what different parts of space might smell like is really a cool way of getting a better understanding of cosmic chemistry. And you being a man of chemistry background, it's a thing that you like to study, as you're involved in that sort of stuff. So, during the Apollo landings, the astronauts would often comment on a gunpowdery type smell once they had clambered back into the airlock and entered the confines of the lunar lander and removed their helmets. That's just one of them as well. And while an astronaut is on a spacewalk, now this is what happens as well, so they can be out there for 6.5 hours or so, single atoms of oxygen can adhere to their spacesuit, which would probably make sense in a way, and when they re-enter the airlock and repressurize, molecular oxygen, which is O2, Mm-hmm. Yeah, or two atoms of oxygen floods into the airlock and combines with the single oxygen atoms to form ozone or O3, which would explain the sour metallic smell. So there's all sorts of different smells that they get from space. And if you, you can study this a little bit further if you go on to the Google land, Google world. And it's quite interesting for a good read, a good bedtime read.
Mm. I've also read that those astronauts that go up to the International Space Station, in, whether it's the Soyuz craft or whether it's the shuttle or the newer Elon Musk's SpaceX rockets, what you call them, and the, I've forgotten them, the name escapes me for the moment. But anyway, when they open the hatch into the International Space Station, so one of the smells they get almost immediately, or some people have detected, is BO, because, of course, you've usually already maybe seven astronauts up there for weeks. Now, they do washing, they have laundry, yeah, but it's not conventional type of, and being in zero G, they don't have your standard automatic washing machine or showers. They have a special way of showering, but I have heard that it was, sometimes they get this kind of that body odor type of smell.
Yeah, it's remarkable how water sticks to the skin. If you were to fire a glass of water, it would just be a big ball. But once it hits your skin, it just sucks in. And you use a flannel or a cloth of some sort to do the washy little bits.
Ooh, that's more chemistry, John.
Yes, it is. It's remarkable to see. If you've never seen it, go, I suppose, onto NASA at some stage. You'll find somewhere where they've done experiments with water and the way they can bounce them around the place and suck them in and, you know, hit them with table tennis bats and all sorts of things. And lose tomatoes, of course.
Not the tomatoes again. You're listening to The Astronomy Show here on 103.2 Dublin City FM with John Dixon and myself, Ben Emmett. And our email address is astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And the text and WhatsApp number is 087-179-1032. That's 087-179-1032.
I was reading earlier on about our own black hole that we have in the centre of the Milky Way. It's an absolute monster. And it's something that millions of Earths get inside it. And there's normally one that's in the centre of any of these galaxies as well. But sometimes there are two. But this particular one is just an absolute monster. And it's worth reading about as well. Now, there's been an Earth-sized planet discovered in our own solar backyard, would you believe? And a team of astronomers have discovered a planet closer and younger than any other Earth-sized world yet identified. It's a remarkably hot world whose proximity to our own planet and to a star like our sun mark it as a unique opportunity to study how planets evolve. So, the planet is known as HD63433D, and after I just say that, you will have forgotten exactly what it is. And it's been found in orbit around a star called HD63433. So we have the little planet, and we have the parent star without the D. It's like a fault in your engine. Really, you get a letter after the number it is. So there we go. Even though it's really close orbiting, we can use follow-up data to search for evidence of outgassing the atmospheric loss that could be important in the constraints of how terrestrial worlds evolve. And it's interesting. And they reckon that this particular one reaches a brutal 2,300 degrees Fahrenheit. Did you do a sum on that earlier on?
I just said a quick calculation. And, new money, just under 1,300 degrees centigrade.
Yeah. And that would be enough to have lava. And, of course, the other side is forever dark, so there's something strange about this.
They think it's because it's so... the planet itself is around about the same size as the Earth, and the star it orbits is around about, and quite similar, about the same size and quite like same type of star as the Sun. But because it's so close, it takes the planet only less than 4.5 Earth days to orbit the star, and they think most likely because of that it is tidally locked. In other words, that the one face of the planet faces the star all the time. Just like the moon is tidally locked with the Earth, we only see one side of it at any one time. So one side, as they say, is about 1,300 degrees centigrade all the time, And as you mentioned, John, the other side is always in the dark. And how cold it is now is a good question. Probably vary, because I would imagine, although I can't be sure, that the so close and so hot it has no atmosphere, and that therefore there'll be very little heat transfer from the hot side to the cold side. And so it's permanently boiling hot. I think you'd definitely melt lead at that temperature. And the other side is probably close to absolute zero. Apparently on a dark night, you can see this through a good pair of binoculars. It's not that far away. How far is it? And they reckon, of course, the star at which this planet is orbiting is only about 400 million years old, so it's only a youngster compared with our own Earth, which is about 5 billion years old. Oh, the star is about 73 light years away, up there in the direction of Ursa Major, which includes the Big Dipper, or the Plough, as we call it.
Yeah, I'm reminded here by Alan again that the Hubble telescope has revealed a galaxy that contains a supernova, which is 2.5 billion times brighter than our sun. Now, you definitely would need a pair of solar glasses for that one.
Well, if you were anywhere near it.
Yeah, you'd burn anyway, I would imagine, this thing. But that, it just gives you the thoughts that of the size and vastness of the whole universe as well. And even going back to 4.5 billion, whatever it is, years ago, it's hard to grasp that sort of thing. Okay, we would have been a little bit molten in those days, but when it cooled down a little bit, wouldn't it be wonderful just to see what was around us, life evolved? So there we go, a supernova, 2.5 billion times brighter than the sun. And the other thing about space as well is there would have been a massive explosion with that. Of course, being in space, you wouldn't have heard it. The sound doesn't travel through space.
it needs a medium. Speaking of big numbers, which you can't get your head around, you know, we can calculate big numbers, but we don't really have any concept of it. I mean, we calculate that the universe is about 13.8 billion years old at this stage. Now, we have a concept of what a day is like, or 40 years or we have a concept of maybe what 300 years is, or maybe 1,000 years. But 14,300 million years is just beyond comprehension, even though we can calculate it with fairly good accuracy. But when you mentioned that, John, I was just thinking of a PhD student in the University of Central Lancashire who discovered two huge objects. Well, they're not singular objects in the universe. One is called the Big Ring on the Sky, and it's 9.2 billion light years from Earth. It has a diameter of about 1.3 billion light years and a circumference of about 4 billion light years. And if we could see it in the sky, it's too dim to see, it would the Big Ring would need about 15 full moons to cover it. And this PhD student by the name of Alexia Lopez also 2 years ago discovered the giant arc in the sky, and remarkably enough they are in the same region of the sky and about the same distance away. And this big ring and the giant arc is about 3.3 billion light years across, and they cover about 12 degrees of the sky, or 24 full moons. I mean, there's a wadge of like huge numbers, which are totally incomprehensible, I suppose. But it's, you know, in a way they're meaningless.
It is incomprehensible.
I don't know if you ever read some of the stories about how rich certain people are. This person is, you know, again, we have a concept of what maybe 5 million euro would be, or 20, and then you have billions, and then there's the richest people who have over $1,000 million dollars in wealth. Just what can you do with all that?
What can they do with that? Have a good go at spending it. That's what I would do. Or add a bit to it and pay off the mortgages or something
Like
that.
There you go.
There we go. Putting a moon base on the moon, I suppose, and the Mars base on Mars, is a head scratcher. And researchers have taken the first steps towards finding liquid solvents that may someday help extract critical building materials from the lunar and the Martian rock dust, which is an ongoing thing and an important piece of making long-term space travel possible. Now, in behind the scenes, no doubt there are oodles and oodles of different teams and companies trying to come up with ideas on how to quickly, I suppose, build up like a 3D printer, that type of thing, but using different types of solvents and things, although they're not good for us down here. It wouldn't be too bad, I suppose, up there, but to be able to insulate from the heat of the sun, etc., and from the cold if you're down in underneath. So these powerful solvents, as they call them, are called ionic liquids and are salts. Would you believe that are in a liquid state? And the machine learning work brought us down to the 20,000 foot to the 1,000 foot level. So it's getting closer and closer, and they're able to down-select a lot of ionic liquids very quickly, and then we would also scientifically understand the most important factors that determine whether the solvent would actually dissolve in the material or not out in space as well. So, as I say, there's a lot of homework being done and a lot of sleepless nights by teams and teams and companies and researchers trying to get their heads around how they're going to build a little place on the moon, or indeed Mars.
More chemistry? Solvents?
Yeah.
Polar solvents and non-polar solvents. Maybe we'll do a program on that sometime.
Solvents, yeah.
I'll do that one.
Yeah, there you go. That one, that'll be up to you. You're the man for that, definitely. Yeah,
I know. Very sad. Before we go, I just wanted to mention China's Gravity One. It's a private Beijing-based company, and they have built a rocket 30 meters tall, and it is the most powerful of solid-fueled launch vehicles. It has three core stages, four boosters, powered by solid propellants, motors, and it's equipped with flexible swinging nozzles, which is an innovation in rocket technology, with a liftoff weight of 405 metric tons and a thrust of 600 tons, and it can launch 6.5 tons to low Earth orbit or 4.25 tons into a typical sun synchronous orbit at an altitude of about 500 kilometers or so, and it boasts the largest fairings among the country's private rockets. Basically, it's a big, powerful rocket, and there's some more numbers to you on. Sorry for giving you so many numbers this evening to think about, but that's the way it is at the moment. I think, are we out of time?
Just before we go, I did catch this earlier on as well, that well, we know that there may have been liquid water of some sort on the planet of Mars. Now they reckon that water may have flowed through the Martian valleys countless times at this stage. So a new experiment's going on that. I won't go into this detail in this week because we've run out of time, unfortunately.
Thank you, John, for that and for your other news items. Our email address, any comments, queries or questions you may have, we'd love to hear from you. It's astronomy@dublincityfm.ie. And thanks to James Sweeney and Carla Lennon for making the show available on astronomy.ie for the good people here also in Dublin City FM who put this program up as a podcast. But that's all from me, Ben Emmett, from this edition of The Astronomy Show here on 103.2. Dublin City FM, and from now until 2 a.m. it's music all the way here with Bren Lynott next with Threads, and from 10 p.m. to midnight, Ear to the Globe with Nigel Wood, and from midnight till 2 a.m. Dave Barry's After Hours mix of jazz, blues and soul. But please join myself and John at the same time next week, that's 7:30 p.m. when we'll be back with all the latest news from around the universe. Until then, take care of each other. Thank you for listening and say goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Goodnight, John.
Broadcasting on 103.2, this is Dublin City FM.